Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week one of our bi-weekly issue, so I'll be reading you the feature stories, and our first one is Cybersecurity Experts Are Sounding the Alarm on Doge, and this is by Andrew R. Chow. Since January, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, Doge, has carved up federal programs, removing positions related to hazardous waste removal, veteran support, and disease control, among others. While many have already been affected, cybersecurity experts worry about the impacts not yet realized in the form of hacks, fraud, and privacy breaches. Doge has fired top cybersecurity officers from various agencies, gutted the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, CISA, and canceled at least 32 cybersecurity-related contracts with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB. Cybersecurity experts, including those fired by Doge, argue that the agency has demonstrated questionable practices toward regarding the vast amount of personal data the government holds, including in agencies such as the Social Security Administration and the Department of Veteran Affairs, VA. Last week, a court filing revealed that a Doge staffer violated a Treasury Department policy by sending an email containing encrypted personal information. I see Doge actively destroying cybersecurity barriers within government in a way that endangers the privacy of American citizens, says Jonathan Kamens, who oversaw cybersecurity for VA.com until February when he was let go. That makes it easier for bad actors to gain access. Doge's access to some agencies' data has been limited in response to dozens of filed lawsuits. But those battles play out in court, Doge continues to have access to huge amounts of sensitive data. Here's what cybersecurity experts caution is at stake. Personal information. As Doge picked up steam following the inauguration, cybersecurity experts began voicing concern about the new organization's privacy practices and digital hygiene. Reports surfaced that Doge members connected to government networks on unauthorized servers and shared information over unsecure channels. Last month, the Doge.gov website was altered by outside coders who found that they could publish updates to the website without authorization. The same month, Treasury officials said that a 25-year-old Doge staffer was, quote, mistakenly, end quote, given temporary access to make changes to a federal payment system. Cybersecurity experts find these lapses concerning because the government stores vast amounts of data to serve Americans. For instance, the Department of Veterans Affairs stores the bank accounts and credit card numbers of millions of veterans who receive benefits and services. The department also collects medical data, social security numbers, and the names of relatives and caregivers, says Kamens, who says he was the only federal employee at the agency with an engineering technical background overseeing cybersecurity for VA.gov. Kamens says he was hired in 2023 in part to improve several specific security issues for the site, which he declined to name due to confidentiality reasons. Now, he says, hackers could take advantage of those unresolved issues to learn potentially compromising information about veterans and then target them with phishing campaigns. Peter Kasperowitz, VA's press secretary, wrote to Time in an email that VA employs hundreds of cybersecurity personnel who are dedicated to keeping the department's websites and beneficiary data safe 24/7. Erie Meyer, former chief technologist at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, resigned in February after DOGE members showed up at the agency's offices requesting data privileges. Her role focused on safeguarding the CFPB's sensitive data, including transaction records from credit reporting agencies, complaints filed by citizens, and information from big tech companies under investigation. There are a bunch of careful protections in place that layer onto each other to make sure that no one could exploit that information, Meyer says. But DOGE slashed many of those efforts, including the regular upkeep of audit and event logs, which showed how and when employees were accessing that information. The software we had in place tracking what was being done was turned off, she says. This means that DOGE employees could now have access to financial data with no oversight as to how they are accessing it, Myers says. Myers is also concerned about the cancellation of dozens of cybersecurity contracts, which included deals with companies who performed security equipment disposal, provided VPNs to government employees, and encrypted email servers. People need us when the worst financial disasters are happening to their family, she says. It's sloppy to open them up to fraud like this. A representative for the CFPB did not immediately respond to a request for comment. In an email statement to Time, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt wrote, quote, President Trump promised the American people that he would establish a Department of Government Efficiency overseen by Elon Musk to make the federal government more efficient and accountable to taxpayers. DOGE has fully integrated into the federal government to cut waste, fraud, and abuse. Rogue bureaucrats and activist judges attempting to undermine this effort are only subverting the will of the American people, and their obstructionist efforts will fail, end quote. In addition to being worried about what DOGE is doing with citizens' data, cybersecurity experts are concerned that their aggressive tactics could make it easier for scammers to infiltrate systems, which could have disastrous consequences. For instance, DOGE currently has access to Social Security Administration data, which includes personal information about elderly Americans. Kamens notes that scammers often use personal information, such as an individual bank or hospital, in order to convince them that they're a trusted person. And these tactics seem to work especially well on the elderly, who are less tech savvy. Roughly $3.4 billion in fraud losses was reported by people ages 60 and up in 2023, I3C found. These vulnerabilities also extend to matters of national security. DOGE members themselves would immediately become targets for foreign state actors, Kamen says. And earlier this month, Rob Joyce, the former leader of the NSA's unit focusing on foreign computer systems, warned that DOGE's mass firing of probationary federal employees would have a devastating impact on cybersecurity and our national security. About 130 of those fired probationary officers were part of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, CISA, which is tasked with detecting breaches of the nation's power grid, pipelines, and water system. CISA was already understaffed to begin with, says Michael Daniel, president and CEO of the Cyber Threat Alliance, and a cybersecurity coordinator under President Obama. It's possible that a critical infrastructure owner and operator might not be able to get assistance from CISA as a result of the cuts. Senator Elizabeth Warren penned a letter arguing that DOGE posed a national security threat by exposing secrets about America's defense and intelligence agencies. We don't know what safeguards were pulled down. Are the gates wide open now for hackers from China, from North Korea, from Iran, from Russia? She said in a statement. Heck, who knows what black hat hackers all around the world are finding out about each one of us and copying that information for their own criminal uses. Cybersecurity experts are also worried about the risk of DOGE engineers inadvertently breaking parts of the government's digital systems, which can be archaic and deeply complex, or unintentionally introducing malware to the essential code. In particular, financial experts have said that mistakes made with the Treasury Department's delicate systems could harm the U.S. economy. Kamens warns that if DOGE interferes with the Social Security system, Medicare reimbursements or disability payments could fail to go out on time, endangering lives. They have fired the people who know where the danger points are, he says. Last week, a federal judge questioned government attorneys about why DOGE needs access to Social Security Administration systems and is still considering whether to shut off access. Another lawsuit filed by 19 state attorneys general in an attempt to block DOGE's access to the Treasury Department in February is ongoing. Kamens adds that the security risks could only heighten over time, especially if roles like his remain unfilled. Nearly everyone that he worked with at USDS, DOGE's precursor, came into government from the private sector, he says, and he worries that top-level cybersecurity professionals will not want to join the federal staff due to the instability and the risks of being fired or undermined. This lack of staffing, he says, could prevent the government from mitigating new and evolving attacks. The reality is that there are constantly new security holes being discovered, he says. If you're not actively evolving your cyber defenses to go along with the offensive things that are happening in that landscape, you end up losing ground. Daniel says that just because nothing has been broken yet does not mean that DOGE is doing an adequate job in stopping cybersecurity threats. It's not an instant feedback loop, he says. That's part of the challenge here. We're talking about an increase in risk that may play out over an extended period of time. And this story is by Andrew R. Chow for this week's Time magazine. Folks, our next feature story is the unexpected mental toll of spending months in space. This is another feature story from this week's Time magazine. The longest 8 days that Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams ever spent turned out to last more than 9 months. On June 5th, 2024, the two NASA astronauts launched aboard the maiden mission of Boeing's new Starliner spacecraft for what was supposed to be a short shakedown cruise to the International Space Station, ISS, before turning around and heading home after just over a week. A veteran of two long-duration station rotations, Williams had spent a cumulative 322 days in space before her June launch. While to all appearances, she has always thrived on her off-planet work, she was excited about this planned quickie mission. We wanted to go and get back as quickly as possible so they can turn our spacecraft around and also take all of those lessons learned and incorporate them into the next Star Learner, she told Time in a conversation before the launch. But that was not to be. Thruster problems and helium leaks aboard Starliner led NASA to conclude that the spacecraft was not fit to carry the astronauts home. Instead, the ship left the station and splashed down uncrewed, leaving Wilmore and Williams to join the station rotation, living and working aboard the ISS until a fresh SpaceX crew Dragon spacecraft arrived to take them home. After much anticipation, that ship docked with the station on March 16th, and the two astronauts climbed aboard for an ocean landing later today, March 18th, a full 278 days after they were originally scheduled to depart the ISS. So, what kind of emotional adjustment did Williams and Wilmore have to make as they went from overnight guests to long-term residents aboard the station? And what will the reacclimation to life on Earth be like after so much time away from home and family, and for that matter, from sunshine, fresh air, and the simple fact of gravity? Ever since the first astronauts and cosmonauts went aloft, they've been having to make that through the looking glass transition between terrestrial and extraterrestrial living, and the results have been sometimes comical, sometimes surreal. In 1965, astronauts Frank Borman and Jim Lovell spent a then record 2 weeks orbiting Earth in their Gemini 7 spacecraft. Lovell recalls being below decks, according to the recovery vessel, the USS Wasp, shortly after splashdown and being evaluated by a NASA psychologist. Lovell was drinking coffee and had a spoon in one hand. Meaning to put it down, he instead simply released it a foot above the table, leaving it to fall with a clatter. The psychologist looked at him curiously, and Lovell just shrugged. After a fortnight in zero gravity, he was used to letting go of objects in midair and having them accommodatingly float where they were. In 1971, astronaut Dave Scott had a more otherworldly experience. The commander of Apollo 15, Scott walked on the moon, returned to Earth, and a few days later was feted by his neighbors at a welcome home cookout. Standing in his backyard, well wishes circulating, he looked up at the sky where a bright moon was shining. A week ago, he thought incredulously, I was there. Before Wilmore and Williams make the adjustment of returning to Earth, of course they had to prepare themselves for leaving it in the first place, and that was a process they were at least partially denied. Training for a long-duration space mission is equal parts physical and mental, and it's that mental piece, saying goodbye to all earthly people and things for half a year or more, that they missed out on, instead training for just an 8-day mission. That comes at a price. In 2015, Time visited Russia's Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan to film the documentary series A Year in Space about astronaut Scott Kelly's nearly 12-month stay aboard the ISS. Just 2 days before Kelly launched from Baikonur, Time spoke to astronaut Jeffrey Williams, part of the backup crew, who would have flown in Kelly's place if he were unable for some reason to go. He confessed that if that day, 48 hours before liftoff, Kelly was suddenly scratched from the flight, it would be a challenge for him to get up to speed mentally, since there is simply no substitute for having fully and wholly prepared for for the actual fact that he would be leaving Earth for a year. Retired astronaut Mike Massimino, a veteran of 2 shuttle missions, says that missing family was likely the hardest mental challenge that Wilmore and Williams faced. Although they love their jobs and are grateful for the opportunity, there is still the heart tug of being away from home for so long, he says. Still, to all appearances at least, Wilmore and Williams quickly fit into the ISS life cycle, at least if NASA live streams of the pair at work beside the station and during spacewalks were any indication. Suni has just oozed such joy for the past 8 months, says retired astronaut Marcia Irvins, a veteran of 5 space shuttle missions and a friend of both Wilmore and Williams. It's infectious to watch her. We came up prepared to stay long, even though we plan to stay short, Wilmore said in a recent air-to-ground press conference. That's what we do in human spaceflight. All career astronauts know the risks involved in human spaceflight, long or short duration, and they accept those risks when they strap into the rocket for launch, says Irvins. A large part of our training is to learn to deal with the unexpected, the off-nominal, the contingency scenarios, and still get the job done. Coming home will present different challenges. The toughest thing about returning to Earth after many months in space is adapting to gravity, says retired astronaut Terry Virts, a veteran of 2 space flights, including 1 long-duration stay as ISS commander. The grueling rehab program that NASA put me through was key to my quick adaptation back to my planet. The first few days weren't fun, but I was religious about doing my daily workouts, and I was back to driving and normal daily life much more quickly than I expected. The mental part, as Apollo 15 commander Scott experienced, is critical too. It's important to get back in Earth mode from a psychological perspective, says Virts. For me, it was like a light switch. One day I was living in space, and as soon as I got back to Houston, I was just back to my normal life. It's really important to have goals and things to look forward to down here, as you may or may not get another chance to fly in space. It's way too early to say if Wilmore or Williams will fly again, or whether their extended stay aboard the ISS will be their last trip off the Earth. Astronaut Peggy Whitson holds the U.S. record for most cumulative days in space at 675. Williams is now in the number 2 spot at 608 days, and Wilmore has logged a very considerable 464. That might be more than enough for any mortal, astronaut or not. If Wilmore and Williams indeed step away from space, they will do so having distinguished themselves, as Irvins puts it, the most off-nominal of missions. Suni and Butch accepted the unexpected extension to their mission with such grace and humor, she says. Their demonstration of flexibility, adaptability, and optimistic versatility in folding seamlessly into the onboard crew is exactly what one should hope for from a career astronaut, and it makes me even more proud to call them my friends. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds, and this is week 1 of our biweekly issue of Time Magazine. We've had a couple of feature stories, and now we're going to move forward with a third. This one is Driving Force. With his move to Ferrari, Lewis Hamilton aims to cement his status as Formula One's greatest athlete ever. This is by Sean Gregory in London. On Valentine's Day, Lewis Hamilton enters a sprawling studio space in northwest London and intently stares at the magnificent creature standing off in the distance. SH blank, says Hamilton, to no one in particular. I'm nervous. Soon enough, however, the seven-time Formula One world champion overcomes his anxiety and is standing face-to-face with a shiny black stallion named Aroma. He pets his nose, massages his neck, and generally spreads his hands all over Aroma's thick coat. He's doing his allergies, the source of his initial fear, no favors. But Hamilton, a literal knight, is enamored, peppering the horse master with questions. Where is Aroma from? Portugal. Can he sleep lying down? Yes. How much does he weigh? About 1,300 pounds. Only a few hundred less than Hamilton's race car. He's throwing health caution to the wind in order to commemorate his much ballyhooed move from Mercedes, where he won 6 of his 7 Formula One driver titles, to the venerated Scuderia Ferrari HP race team. A photo of himself positioned in front of an actual black horse standing on its hind legs, mimicking the Italian automaker's famous logo. Like Hamilton, Aroma, who is retired but still does the occasional photo shoot, has an impressive resume, including appearances in Robin Hood and Maleficent, ads for Hermes and Burberry, and a Dua Lipa video. He is joined by Theo, a stunt horse you might recognize from Bridgerton, among other things. This is going to be such an iconic picture, says Hamilton, while trying on outfits for the shoot. Super timeless. That depends, of course, on what comes after. At the age of 40, Hamilton is aiming not only to win a record 8th Formula One driver title, cementing his status as the greatest F1 driver to ever live and ending the longest ever championship drought for the most storied race team on the planet, but also fulfill a lifelong dream. His move to Ferrari, announced before the 2024 season, was shocking worldwide front page news. He had suited up for Mercedes for more than a decade, helped build a more diverse workforce there, and hoped to someday acquire an ownership stake in the team. It seemed that he would ride into the sunset with the silver arrows. Hamilton had other ideas. You can't stand still for too long, Hamilton tells Time, in his first in-depth interview about his decision to leave Mercedes for Ferrari. I needed to throw myself into something uncomfortable again. Honestly, I thought all my firsts were done. Your first car, your first rash, your first date, your first day of school. The excitement I got by the idea of, this is my first time in this red suit, the first time in the Ferrari. Wow. Honestly, I've never been so excited. During the 2024 Formula One season, Hamilton, out of respect for Mercedes, with whom he was still under contract and racing, didn't talk much about the switch. The situation was awkward and unprecedented. Picture LeBron James suiting up for the Los Angeles Lakers, knowing he'd be playing the following year for a rival like the Boston Celtics. Exactly. It would never happen. All sides appear to have handled it as professionally as possible. Hamilton ended a 945-day losing streak by winning his hometown race at Silverstone in Britain in July before winning again in Belgium 3 weeks later. Meanwhile, Carlos Sainz, the Ferrari driver whom Hamilton is replacing this year, helped Scuderia finish second in the constructor or team standings, just a few points behind the 2024 champion McLaren. Hamilton's road to the title record won't be easy. Some critics have questioned Ferrari's strategy of signing an aging driver whose best days could very well be in the rear view. They've wondered whether Ferrari's more interested in marketing than winning. Hamilton is still F1's most popular driver by a mile, as well as an internationally known cultural figure with a hand in fashion, film, and business. He's co-chairing the Met Gala in May, alongside of Coleman Domingo, Pharrell Williams, ASAP Rocky, and Anna Wintour. LeBron James is honorary chair. Plus, a slew of younger drivers, like reigning four-time champion Red Bull's Max Verstappen, 27, McLaren's Lando Norris, 25, and Hamilton's new Ferrari teammate, Charles Leclerc, 27, could keep him off the top of the podium. "The old man is a state of mind," says Hamilton. "Of course your body ages, but I'm never going to be an old man." The 2025 F1 campaign, which kicks off in Australia in March, comes laced with intrigue. Hamilton sits at the epicenter. Ferrari is religion in Italy. When the team wins an F1 race, the bells of the Church of St. Blaise in Maranello, the small city near Bologna that houses Ferrari headquarters, ring in celebration. So, Hamilton's quest to end Ferrari's agony, while breaking the individual title record set by Michael Schumacher, who won 5 straight titles with Ferrari from 2000 to 2004, will be appointment theater. Meanwhile, Hamilton is co-producing, along with Jerry Bruckheimer and others, an F1 movie aptly called F1 that is almost literally a Brad Pitt vehicle. The film, which comes out in June, plus a competitive race for the championship, could deliver a jolt to the sport's popularity, especially in the U.S., where F1 has boomed and flattened out a bit, given Verstappen's predictable dominance. A Hamilton championship in red, in the twilight of his racing life, would be nothing less than one of the greatest mic drop moments in sports history. "I don't know if I can find an adjective to describe that," says American racing legend Mario Andretti, the 1978 F1 champion who raced for Ferrari in the early 70s. Nothing is missing in his career. "But oh man, how better can you describe your career after that? Oh my God, he'd be the king of all kings." 2 weeks before the Stallion photo shoot, Hamilton is striking golf balls into a simulator at an outdoor club on the banks of the Thames. He has a pronounced slice. He doesn't golf much these days, but Hamilton, being Hamilton, a man who has taken full advantage of the sport's jet-setting ways to become one of the world's most prominent collectors of influential people, he last played around with actor Tom Holland, aka Spider-Man. His other golf partners have included Samuel L. Jackson and Kelly Slater, the surfing goat. He was once supposed to play with another goat, Michael Jordan, but when Hamilton got to the course, he said, "Gordon didn't end up being there." As we're taking swings, I ask Hamilton if he's checked out TGL, the indoor golf competition founded by Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy that just launched its first season in the U.S. He hasn't. I explain some of the particulars. It's a team league. ESPN is showing it on weeknights before it sounds familiar. But Hamilton is involved with so many projects: movies, art, fashion lines, the Denver Broncos, a pet food company, a plant-based burger chain with Leonardo DiCaprio that he can't quite remember whether he poured some money into this new outfit. "I might have," he says with a laugh. He did. Hamilton takes a break from golf, reclines on a couch, and orders a latte before sharing the story of how he arrived at this moment. "It began a long time ago, when he was a kid growing up in public housing north of London. His first Ferrari memories have stuck with him. He would drive Schumacher's car in racing video games. the Ferrari replica featured in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the 1961 250 GT California Spider, is still, to this day, Hamilton's favorite. "That's the ultimate retirement car," he says. "I can just see myself with Roscoe, him with a scarf and goggles in the seat next to me, driving down at the PCH. Roscoe, Hamilton's pet bulldog, who, like his owner, is vegan, has an Instagram account with 1.1 million followers. McLaren signed Hamilton to a driver's deal in 1998 when he was 13. In 2006, Hamilton won the championship in what is now known as Formula 2. "I did have the bit of red on my helmet," he says. During that Formula 2 season, and one prior in Formula 3, Hamilton raced for team principal Frederic Vasseur, whose management style and ability to recruit top engineering talent to his lower-level operation impressed the young driver. Hamilton figured Vasseur would be a Formula 1 leader one day. Hamilton won his first F1 championship in 2008, his second season with McLaren. He competed there for four more seasons before jumping in 2013 to Mercedes, a middling team that Hamilton lifted to championship heights. Through it all, Hamilton maintained a cordial relation with Ferrari leadership. He'd walk past the Ferrari garage at races and say ciao to the mechanics and hear them say, "Vieni Ferrari, come to Ferrari." Around 2018, Hamilton met with Ferrari chairman John Elkann, and both sides expressed a desire to see Hamilton in red. But by the end of the 2020 season, Hamilton had four straight championships with Mercedes. He had no reason to jump ship. "If I'm really honest, I had accepted the fact that I'm probably not going to drive for Ferrari," says Hamilton, "and I was okay with that." After the 2021 season, Hamilton nearly walked away from racing. He and millions of his fans felt his record eighth driver title was stolen from him when, during the final race of the year in Abu Dhabi, an official's controversial decision allowed Verstappen to overtake Hamilton in the last lap and clinch his first title. Hamilton ultimately refused to quit without a fight, but he failed to win a single race as Verstappen cruised to another pair of championships. Hamilton signed a two-year extension with Mercedes in the summer of 2023, but the deal allowed him an option to leave after 1 year. Meanwhile, true to Hamilton's prediction, his de facto coach in the minors, Vasseur, took over a Formula One team in 2016. Before the 2023 season, he was hired for a new team principal gig at Ferrari. Vasseur got wind of the loophole in Hamilton's new deal. "He told me at one stage," says Vasseur, "good news, and aimed to sign an agreement with Hamilton before the 2024 season. He wanted his drivers under contract last year, Leclerc and Sainz, to be free of whispers regarding their status. So, when Hamilton was at his home in Colorado in December 2023, he got a call from Vasseur asking him to join Ferrari starting in 2025. "I remember getting off the phone and, like, almost shaking," says Hamilton, who's now almost shaking while recalling the moment. "I was like, oh, God." He told a friend who was with him about the call. They both sat in silence on a bathroom floor in shock. "I was like, holy S," says Hamilton. "I literally just signed with Mercedes. Breaking up with a team that felt like family was far from a no-brainer. And he didn't have much time to decide. It was a lot to take in, and my emotions were really high," says Hamilton. "So I honestly had to go for a walk. He left the house for an hour to decompress." Hamilton then spent a few days meditating. He was leaning toward Ferrari. "My eyes felt really calm and present," he says. "This is the right thing for me." When he switched from McLaren to Mercedes all those years ago, he solicited too much advice. Here, he confided in just a few family members and trusted friends. One cannot discount the Ferrari influence on the sport, especially through the eyes of a child, says Melody Hobson, co-CEO of Ariel Investments and the former chair of the Starbucks board, who's very close to Hamilton. During negotiations, after every phone call with Ferrari, he'd jump around like a little kid. We're in a time of reimagining the future, reimagining what's really we're dreaming about, says Hamilton. "I'm going to Ferrari, man, and that's the biggest dream." And not everyone is so thrilled. The day after he informed Mercedes team principal Toto Wolff of his decision was Hamilton's annual paintball outing with his race team mechanics. When he arrived, he was too nervous to get out of his car. "These are guys I've been with so many years," says Hamilton. He eventually stood on top of a table to address his decision. His squad appeared understanding and supportive, but they let him have it in paintball. "They lit me up hard," says Hamilton. "It was so painful." At one point, he was hiding behind a barrel, shooting at the other team, when he was struck from behind. A member of his own squadron had nailed him. "Freaking guy," says Hamilton. They laughed about it afterward and managed to get through the season. "There is no bad blood," says Hamilton. "Absolutely not. We won so many championships." Mercedes declined to comment for this story. Andrea Kimi Antonelli, an 18-year-old from Bologna, will take Hamilton's place in the Mercedes lineup. "They have all the ingredients to win world championships, and they will win more world championships," says Hamilton of Mercedes. "I have no doubt." In a book published in November, Inside Mercedes, Formula One, Life in the Fast Lane, Wolff says that Hamilton's move helps us because it avoids the moment where we need to tell the sport's most iconic driver that we want to stop. We're in a sport where cognitive sharpness is extremely important, and I believe everyone has a shelf life. The comments caused a stir, and Wolff clarified that Hamilton is still very sharp. Hamilton insists that Wolff's remark doesn't bother him. He points to athletes like Tom Brady and LeBron James who've achieved success into their 40s. "Don't ever compare me to anybody else," says Hamilton. "I'm the first and only black driver that's ever been in this sport. I'm built different. I've been through a lot. I've had my own journey. You can't compare me to another 40-year-old, past or present, Formula One driver in history, because they are nothing like me. I'm hungry, driven. I don't have a wife and kids. I'm focused on one thing, and that's winning. That's my number one priority." He also dismisses criticism from broader racing communities. Former F1 team owner Eddie Jordan said in a December podcast that it was absolutely suicidal for Ferrari to drop Sainz from its roster, given the strong working relationship between him and Leclerc. Sainz will now race for Williams. "I've always welcomed the negativity," says Hamilton. "I've never, ever replied to any of the older, ultimately white men who have commented on my career and what they think I should be doing. How you show up, how you present yourself, how you perform slowly dispels that." Others, including former Ferrari driver Jackie Ickx, have suggested that Ferrari signed Hamilton primarily for his commercial value. "I think it's really unfair to Lewis," some of the comments saying, "This is a marketing operation," says Elkann, the Ferrari chairman. Truth said, Lewis doesn't need that. Ferrari doesn't need that. What we need to do is to win championships and to do great things on the track. If that happens, what we can do outside of the track in some ways takes care of itself. There's unlimited possibilities. The pressure, internal and external, that Hamilton faces is immense. No Formula One team owns more constructor titles than Ferrari, but they last won in 2008. Ferrari also owns the driver record with 15, but the last Ferrari driver to win an individual crown was Kimi Räikkönen in 2007. Ferrari fans are so passionate that they go by their own name, the Tifosi. And the Ferrari Museum, not far from the team's 9.3 million square foot campus in Maranello, Italy, pilgrims often start crying or propose marriage in the Hall of Victories, which showcases the team's championship cars and more than 100 trophies. One night in early February, at the Ristorante Montana, which displays a trove of Ferrari memorabilia in its dining room, Andrea Puttini, seller of building materials from Naples, is outside enjoying a smoke. In Italy, we say it's not important if you speak bad or speak good about something, says Puttini. The importance is that you are talking about this. And Hamilton, just for being here, he lets us talk all over the world about Ferrari. Hamilton connected with as many of his new co-workers as possible during his first visit to Maranello in January, shaking hands until his arm was pulsating. The amount of ciao's and grazie's and piaceri's I was saying, ay, 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 he says. After his first test run, he went out to greet the supporters lining a bridge that overlooks Ferrari's private racetrack. A few weeks later, a fan, decked out in a red Ferrari shirt and cowboy hat, cut down a tree to allow the Tifosi a better look at Hamilton's practice. Hamilton first spotted himself in a Ferrari suit when, in of all places, in the loo. He was washing his hands and looking up into the mirror. I'm in red, and I'm like, whoa, he says. He paused for a moment to take in the reflection. He liked what he saw. The suit looked so good on me, says Hamilton, laughing. I'm like, damn. When seated in a Ferrari race car for the first time, he closed his eyes when the engine started and smiled. The vibrations are different, he says. He let them course through his body. You just wonder how that feels, Hamilton says. Now he knows it's a really special moment. Still, Hamilton is well aware that Italian sports fans have not always been so welcoming of black athletes like himself. He competed in karting races there in his younger days, starting at around age 12, and experienced racist abuse, just as he had in England. He prefers not to go into details. I don't want to dwell, he says, but he's heard the racist chants directed at black soccer players in particular. I'm not going to lie. It definitely crossed my mind when I was thinking about my decision, he says. Like in so many things, it's often a small group of people that set the trend for many. I don't think it's going to be a problem. Ferrari's diversity, or lack thereof, was Hamilton's more pressing concern. In the wake of George Floyd's 2020 murder, as part of the worldwide sports protest movement against racial injustice, Hamilton started the Hamilton Commission to offer recommendations for more black representation in UK motorsports. Mercedes launched its own diversity initiative in the months that followed and began hiring personnel from underrepresented groups, including black engineers. I did think, oh my God, I finally got a more diverse working environment that we've built over time, says Hamilton. And now I'm going back to the beginning of my time with Mercedes, where it wasn't diverse. Along with every other F1 team, Ferrari signed a diversify and inclusion charter in November. While the new Trump administration has made a point of attacking diversity, the president has signed a series of executive orders targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Hamilton, for one, remains locked in. I am not going to change what he does or what the government does. All I can do is try to make sure that in my space, in my environment, I'm trying to elevate people, he says. There's going to be forces along the way that don't want that, for whatever reason, that I can't fathom. That doesn't stop me. It's a fight that we'll just keep fighting. Hamilton is confident that Ferrari is committed to inclusion. Vasseur, Hamilton's new boss, agrees that it's important, though as he fiddles with a binder clip in the office at Ferrari headquarters, where trade secrets are so closely guarded, visitors must place stickers over their mobile phone cameras, red ones, of course, he suggests that it may not be his top goal. It's not politically correct, but first is performance, he says. I'm keen to go into the direction of diversity and so on. We are doing our best effort. We are trying to push in this direction, but I want to build up the best team. I show Vasseur, who hails from France, a photo I found online. It's him and Hamilton some 20 years ago celebrating a win. He shows me some photos on his own phone of his children, who are now grown, with Hamilton. He's enjoying the walk down memory lane. But, he says, we can't be sentimental. Switching teams is difficult for any driver. The steering wheel, the cockpit, the terminology, they're all different. But I'm literally learning a completely new book, says Hamilton. F1 regulations allow limited practice time in the new car. He has made strides in his Italian, thanks to lessons, but he is by no means fluent. It took Hamilton more than 4 months to win a race in his first season with Mercedes. What gives Vasseur confidence is that Hamilton will accelerate that learning curve. I could reply like a book and give you something that you want to write, Vasseur replies. But at the end of the day, at this part of the season, the feeling, the first time, blah, 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 will be nothing compared to racing in Australia. You will forget about everything that happened before. It's all about pure performance. Hamilton believes that he and Leclerc are the strongest team pairing in the sport and that Verstappen is absolutely beatable. I know exactly where the North Star is, says Hamilton. I know where I need to go, and I know how to get there. It's far, and it's going to be tough to get there, but I know that I've got all the ingredients, all the people, an amazing team around me. So it's how much you want it. And I can't express to you how much I want it. Folks, that does it for Time Magazine today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.